Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, slamming into your radio like a supercharged particle of dark energy, squeezing your brain, messing with your mind, and hopefully keeping you up so late you'll have to call in sick tomorrow to work. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the epicenter of excess, the planetary capital of fun, sun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas. You've heard the slogan, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It's a great ad campaign, except for the fact that it simply is not true. Just ask David Copperfield, or OJ, or Britney. What happens in Vegas goes everywhere. My name is George Knapp. I'm your host, your trail guide, your designated driver for the next few hours. It's my privilege to pull up a chair and chew the fat on the third Sunday of each month. And here we are. I think we're going to have some fun tonight talking about conspiracies and cover-ups and UFOs, three of my favorites. Coming up in this hour, pilot and UFO researcher John Lear will check in with a couple of strange stories you probably haven't heard before. John has sort of become the unofficial conspiracy correspondent for me anyway, and he's dug up a couple of doozies for us tonight. And then in hour two, British author Tim Good will join us from London. Tim has written some of the most important and influential books about UFOs and government secrecy in modern history. He's got a new one out that's going to knock your socks off, and I can't wait to get into it with him. For those of you who don't know me, in my day job, I'm an investigative reporter for KLAS-TV here in Las Vegas. I've been covering this amazing city for a long time, basically since the Jurassic period, I think, or at least that's how it feels at times. But, you know, when it comes to radio, I'm still in my rookie season, still kind of stumbling around in the dark, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. This is the fourth time I've sat in this chair in 2007. It's a lot of fun. And don't get me wrong, I love TV news, and I think I have one of the coolest jobs in journalism. But, you know, radio has some advantages over TV. For one thing, in radio, the broadcasters don't have to wear a coat and tie. And that is a major consideration in my book. And, I'm wearing them anyway. You know, I'm wearing a conservative dark blue single-breasted Armani button-down shirt, subdued Jerry Garcia tie. And Ray, the engineer here, will back me up on this, right, Ray? Yeah. Yeah, he's agreeing. But it occurs to me that I could stroll into the studio wearing buttless leather chaps and a rhinestone tank top or a psychedelic moo-moo, or what I'm actually wearing, which is like shorts and tennies and a baseball hat. But I like the idea of having the option. You know, you can't get away with that on television. As mentioned, I'm still trying to get my bearings in this particular medium. And what amazes me most about the Coast to Coast show is the level of personal investment that the regular listeners have and express. I think my old friend Art Bell created a monster, and George Norrie has been feeding that monster. And the listeners really seem to feel they have a stake in the show and are not shy in the least about venting. Here's what's good. Here's what's not good. I like this. I hate that. There's no ambivalence in this audience. I probably shouldn't do it, but I've been sampling public opinion about the show. Each time I've hosted, I get all these emails about various online forums where the listeners chat about the show, the guests, the hosts, the commercials, the songs that are used between breaks, everything. I mean, I had no idea. A couple of times I've clicked on these links to see what people are saying. It's amazing. I mean, it's like a blow-by-blow, play-by-play kind of an accounting. And people are chatting in between, and suddenly some of them will go to bed and sign off, and it's amazing to me. Obviously, I know the Coast to Coast program is popular. I know it has a large audience and solid ratings, but there's something else going on here. Some sort of personal involvement that I don't really understand just yet. There are all these websites and chat groups that analyze and dissect every show and everything that's said on every show. A Fantastic Forum and Banal of America and Above Top Secret and Godlike Productions and a lot of other ones. The listeners chime in. It's like play-by-play color commentators. Hey, he really screwed up there, or that was a lame joke, or why didn't he ask this question or that question? It's amazing. But it's also brutal at times. Someone forwarded a particular exchange to me. They were talking about one of the first shows I hosted. Someone wrote something nice about me on this site, and then someone else chimed in and wrote that George Knapp is an asshat. An asshat. I mean, I was crushed. Who wants to be known as an asshat? Geez, that's pretty low, I think. It's a kind of label that could follow a person forever. And then it occurred to me, I don't know what an asshat is. What does that mean? Is someone suggesting my ass is shaped like a hat? And if so, what kind of hat? A bowler? A derby? One of those Buckingham Palace Marge Simpson hairdo kind of hats? Or they're saying my head is shaped like buttocks. I mean, seriously, I don't know what an ass hat is, but it doesn't sound like a compliment. I could be wrong. Maybe it's a term of respect among certain indigenous societies. You know, make way, kneel down, here comes the exalted ass hat. I can handle that. I've been called worse, I think, daily, in fact. What's stuck in my head about the coast-to-coast discussion groups is the degree of commitment that many of the listeners have to the show. It's encouraging, yet scary at the same time. You got to be on your toes because someone will call you on it if you're not. I get a lot of emails each time I host, and I can only imagine what George and Art get. It must be overwhelming. I try to answer every one of them, even if it's just a quick thank you to write back. You know, most of them are pretty positive notes from regular listeners. A few are pretty harsh. More than a few are just weird. I mean, getting emails from a guy who thinks his house is some kind of a giant transmitter. It's sending out radio and TV signals to unknown operatives, and somehow these mystery people are able to control things inside his house like the light switches. I got an email last week from a lady who says she's been living with an alien for the last 30 years. I got a PR release from Robert Burleson in Tennessee to let me know that the Knoxville Guitar Society now has a website. Thanks for the tip, Robert. Interesting note from Dr. Brooks Agnew, who's planning a North Pole inner Earth expedition. Dr. Agnew says it's his mission to, quote, unite the clans of inner Earth enthusiasts. And he wrote to ask if I know anyone willing to invest $3.5 million in this venture to travel deep inside the planet. I mean, man, I wish. Take a little jaunt to the inner Earth? Sign me up. But I find myself a little bit short when it comes to the $3.5 million. Anyone out there in the audience with millions to spare might want to contact the Phoenix Science Foundation in Williamsburg, Kentucky. The doctor is waiting to hear from you, and you let me know how that trip goes. About half of the emails I get have something to do with the male anatomy and what to do with it. Why settle for what you have, the one email says. She'll beg for more, another one bragged. Viagra, Cialis, implants, tonics. Local chicks who need extra lovin' on the side was the slug for one email. Choose your size, or I'm the woman you're looking for, wrote a lady nicknamed KGB Bride. Hello, baby, be the playboy you've always wanted to be. Here's what I'm wondering. Is it something I said? Am I putting out this vibe that inspires these kind of messages? Are my ex-girlfriends out there telling stories about me? Because after getting so many of these with the same basic message, it sure seems like someone's putting out the word that I'm just not cutting the mustard. That said, I like getting your emails. I'll answer all of them, though it's going to take me a while. I'd much rather get emails than phone calls to my work phone, which a lot of you have been doing. That job, the TV job, it's separate from this thing. So please cut me some slack on that. I can't sit on the phone at work and talk long distance about UFOs, much as I would like to. All right, some news items to talk about, and then we'll take a short break. You know, the last time I was here, it was the weekend of O.J. Simpson, who was busted in Las Vegas. And this time, it's David Copperfield. I don't know if you saw this story where you live, but FBI agents raided a Las Vegas warehouse where Copperfield stores a lot of the stuff he uses in his act, his magic act. One source told us the agent seized $2 million in cash, which is strange since they reportedly are investigating a rape allegation made by a Seattle woman. The act supposedly took place in the Bahamas. Why the FBI is investigating a sexual assault case from another country is not at all clear. Copperfield's lawyer denies any sexual assault took place. What happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. Not anymore, anyway. I received an email from Colonel John Alexander, who's been on this program several times over the years, including with me. He saw the story about Copperfield on television in Rwanda. That's where Colonel Alexander's traveling. Drives home the point that the world just isn't as big as it used to be. What happens in Vegas can be in Rwanda by tomorrow. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about some UFOs, and we'll be joined momentarily or a couple of minutes from now by the one and only John Lear. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your guest host, George Knapp. We're talking about some things related to news here out of Las Vegas. In a couple of minutes, I'll be joined by John Lear, talk about UFOs and conspiracy, and then later in this program, we'll be joined by author Tim Good from London. Talking about what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. We got an interesting bunch of folks here this weekend in town. IRVA, that's IRVA, the International Remote Viewing Association. They've been in Las Vegas all weekend for their annual convention. Dr. Jacques Vallée, who was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie a few weeks ago, was one of the principal speakers, along with several of the talented professionals who were trained directly by the CIA and or the Army back in the early days of this program. You know, there's some critics who insist there's nothing to this stuff. Millions of dollars were wasted by the government, they say, in the study of remote viewing. It's worthless. I think they're wrong. I think most of the people who are listening to this program probably think they're wrong. Much of the best data to verify the legitimacy of remote viewing remains classified, or at least that's what I've been told. It's not available for review by the general public, including the skeptics who've dismissed the whole thing. But from what I've been told, some of the folks who have worked in this program, there were stunning successes. Documentable, verifiable. There also may have been some spectacular misses by, you know, people who are out to make a buck on this mental protocol, predictions about alien invasions and things like that that have really subjected the whole discipline to ridicule. It's sort of the same with ufology, isn't it? I mean, nutcases and con men make a lot of noise about bogus incidents, and it plays into the hands of those who want to debunk the topic in the first place. I think remote viewing is making a lot of progress on the road to respectability, and one of these days I'm going to sign up for some training myself, and then I can report back to you whether it works or not, at least whether it works for me. I want to update a couple of things we've talked about in the past. If you heard the last show I hosted, you might recall we talked about wild horses. 71 wild horses were found dead on the Tonopah Test Range, otherwise known as Area 52. It's a sister facility to Area 51, the infamous military base here in Nevada. The BLM said it would work with the Air Force to figure out what killed those horses. That's what I reported last time. Actually, they know what killed the horses. It's nitrates, a concentration of nitrates. What they don't know is where all these nitrates came from, how they got into the horses. Well, we're still waiting for answers. I interviewed the BLM a few days ago, and they said they're getting wonderful cooperation from the military, but still the public hasn't been told what happened out there. And in the meantime, more horses have died in another part of Nevada. 156 wild horses that were rounded up from the open range here in Nevada, presumably so they wouldn't starve to death. That's what the BLM said was the reason for this thing. They're taken to this holding facility north of Reno, a place called Palomino Valley. They start getting sick. Then they started dying. Turns out it's from salmonella poisoning. The BLM explains that all wild horses and a lot of other kind of wild animals carry salmonella in their systems. But because these horses had been out on the range surviving on brush, they couldn't handle it when they were brought to this facility and they were fed good, rich hay. You know, they were brought into this pen and fed this richer diet, and somehow that sparked the salmonella that was already in their systems, caused it to flare up. And some of them got pneumonia. Others got real bad diarrhea-like symptoms, and they started keeling over and dying. 156 of them so far. Now, the same BLM official who told me the Tonopah Test Range is just a great place for horses, it's a perfect place except for, you know, the fact that they're dying out there, and the same official who said the military is really doing its best to study these nitrates and get some answers told me that the Palomino Valley facility is just great, and nothing's wrong there. It was just perfect. All these years, they've been rounding up wild horses, supposedly because they're starving. And they didn't know that this is what happens when you feed them hay. They're eating brush out there. You bring them in and feed them hay. They don't know that. Sorry, I don't believe it. And if there's no problem at the Palomino Valley facility, everything's just peachy, then why is it now locked down and quarantined? This wild horse program, as it's being run here in Nevada, is a mess. And whether you care about wild horses or not, it's your tax dollars that are being frittered away by bureaucrats who don't seem to know what the hell they're doing. They'd rather keep thousands and thousands of horses living in these pens, essentially warehoused, feeding them and watering them year after year until they die at great expense to you than to put money into finding them a home and taking them off the government dole. It's just a mess. Some Area 51 news, sort of. You all remember Bob Lazar? I got an email from Bob this week along with an attached clip from a TV program airing on PBS about Lazar's current business. He runs a company called United Nuclear out of his home in New Mexico, and this company sells scientific supplies on the Internet. Chemicals, rocks, weird little devices, oddities, stuff that's often used in high school science labs, even more sophisticated facilities. I think Bob told me that some of his clients are government agencies. And as you might recall from the last time Lazar was on the show last summer, his company had been raided by government agents who seemed to think he's a threat to national security because of the stuff he sells online. The thrust of this PBS program, and I'm sorry, I don't know when it aired or whether it's aired yet. The thrust of it, though, according to Bob, is that science itself is sort of under attack because of terrorism concerns. And I know we all have legitimate reasons to be concerned about terrorism. The question, I guess, is, are we taking it too far? Because chemicals, once widely available to the public, are being restricted. You all know how science works. You know how you got interested in science when you're a kid. Kids get interested in science because they like things that explode or fizzle, things that are slimy, things that are stinky, chemicals that do weird things. It seems a mistake to cut off access to the very substances that get kids interested in science, especially now that the U.S. is already falling behind most of the rest of the world in cutting-edge science and math education. You know, maybe we get Bob back on the show sometime soon to talk about it. He has information about his ongoing fight, I think, on his website, unitednuclear.com. And we'll ask John Lear about this when he comes on in just a minute or so. One other quick Area 51 news item, then we'll get to John. This coming Saturday, the state of Nevada celebrates its entry into the Union, Nevada Day. They have a big parade in our state capital of Carson City. And this year's theme, the organizers selected, is Area 51. So when the organizers came up with that theme, they were trying to think of who could be the grand marshal for the parade, and they thought of me. So I woke up this morning, I cracked the newspaper, the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and there's a shot of me with a photo with a big blank-eating grin on my face. It looks like I just stumbled out of a topless bar at 5 o'clock in the morning or something. I'm wearing shades. And the RJ has run this photo, I don't know, 6 or 7 times before. They did a story about me being an odd choice for the grand marshal of this parade. And then poke some fun at, you know, the fact that previous grand marshals, Clark Gable, Michael Landon, Frank Sinatra Jr., none of them were known to consort with aliens. Boy, I've never heard that joke before. So thanks, RJ, for plugging the parade. And I'd like to say that anyway, if any of you are interested, you know, you can go to Carson City next Saturday. If you live in Northern Nevada, Northern California, anywhere up in that area, the parade starts in the morning. The Mutual UFO Network have its own float. The Roadrunners, the guys who worked at Area 51, will have a presence there. It's a fun time, and heck, I'll be there to say hi as well and to help Nevada celebrate its birthday. I'm going to bring John Lear in right now. This program, listeners to this program know John pretty well, I would think. He's been on with me in the past. He's been on many times with Art and with George, and he's sort of my unofficial conspiracy a consultant and correspondent. John, are you there?
Yeah, George.
John, you and I went over to your house the other day. We were talking about a variety of topics, one of them being the Tonopah Test Range, Area 52. And then we got into something else odd. And I want to introduce this. We got a couple of minutes before we take our bottom of the hour break. It's in a town called Hawthorne, Nevada. There's a big lake out there, Walker Lake, but we're a couple of hundred miles away from the ocean. And yet, there on the side of the road is an odd sign. You know what sign I'm talking about, don't you?
Yeah, it says the Naval Undersea Warfare Center.
Yeah, an undersea warfare center in Hawthorne, Nevada, hundreds of miles from the ocean. Walker Lake isn't big enough for submarines, is it?
No, absolutely not.
So what's your theory about what goes on out there?
It's a submarine base for the Navy. It's the Pacific Ocean underlies the California-Nevada-Arizona plate. And the entrance to this underground naval warfare center is just north of Fort Ord in Monterey Bay. It's about 212 miles, and there's two channels the submarines use. One goes in and one goes out. And, you know, the Naval Undersea Warfare Center, I mean, there's those all over the United States, but that particular one is there because all the ammunition and the bombs and all the ordnance they use is made and stored there by the U.S. Army.
So how did they get submarines to work there? I mean, how do they get in and out?
They have an elevator that goes down 4,300 feet to sea level, And the submarines are there, and it's actually the Pacific Ocean is just below it. It's just getting down to it. Walker Lake, of course, has nothing to do with it. It's only about 15 miles long and only about 80 feet deep, maybe at the deepest. So that has nothing to do with it. But they access the Pacific Ocean through this huge elevator.
That's a wild story, John. When we come back, we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you how you know about this. I know you probably can't reveal your source, but give us a general idea about it. So stick around, everyone. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. We are coming at you, Coast to Coast AM, live from Las Vegas. Our guest is John, for the next half hour, is John Lear. He's a retired airline captain, former CIA pilot, son of the famous inventor of the Lear jet. John has flown over 150 test aircraft. He's won every award granted by the FAA, holds 18 world speed records, and is the unofficial conspiracy correspondent for me on this program. We're going to be right back to ask John about a secret submarine base out here in the middle of the desert, as well as about Area 52, Bob Lazar, Element 115, and maybe torture planes. So don't go away. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host, and I'm joined by John Lear, the one and only. John, before we jump back to talking about this secret submarine base, you sent me an email over the weekend saying, hey, yeah, I'll join you for the show on Sunday, but I'm going out to my mine. What's the deal on the mine?
When I retired from flying, I had this little gold mine up at Gold Butte, Nevada, and got it. It took me about 7 years to get it going, and finally got it going, rebuilt the whole thing, and it was going there for a while. But in 2005, because there was a huge fire up there, which didn't affect my property, I forgot to file the $30 registration fee that you've got to do for a claim every year. And a few months ago, the BLM found out about it, and they said, no, you forgot to file, so you can't have your claims anymore. So it was a great operation. I spent a lot of money, but it's all over now.
Well, I don't understand. Somebody else grabbed it from you, or they're giving it up to somebody, or they just keep it?
It's just that during the time I had it, they filed what they call Area of Critical Environmental Concern, for 1 million acres that they're making in Clark County for a turtle habitat. And when it exempted my mine, but when I missed the filing, you know, for the few days that I did, the mouse trap snapped shut, and there was no way to get back. Now, I appealed to the Interior Board of Land Appeals twice, and even went to Senator Reid, and nobody could do anything about it. So, you know, life is a series of challenges, and it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you meet the challenge. So now I have to clean it up, and that's all there is to that. I'll press on and do other things.
Oh, man, that's a shame. Maybe you and I will talk off the air and see if I can help you in any way. Let's jump back to this discussion about the saucer, the submarine base. You know, I drove up to your beautiful home the other day, and you and I haven't had a face-to-face chat in a while. It's a great view of Las Vegas from where you are up in the mountain there, and we started talking about all kinds of things, and it occurred to me that I have driven by this submarine base probably 100 times, and it's always been curious to me what a submarine base is doing out in the middle of the desert, an undersea warfare center. And you stopped there to sort of take some photos, right, and got ran away?
Yeah, you know, I've been driving up there for 30 years. My folks lived up in Reno, and I go back and forth, and I've seen this there. And seeing the sign, and, you know, up until about 3 years ago, it was the Naval Undersea Warfare Training Center, and then they took the word training out. And, you know, secrets, it takes a long time to put a puzzle together, and what you do is you take information from here and information from there and listen to people, and you read, and, you know, you're not going to find this on the Internet. You have to do it by, you know, personal contact and listen very carefully and read very carefully. And that's how I found out about it. And, you know, I did a lot of flying, and a lot of the people I flew with were ex-military, and they always give, you know, some little secret, and they don't know they really don't know they're doing it, but you put that together and say, ah, okay, I got that one. But, yeah, the other day I was coming back from Reno, and I just wanted to take a picture of the sign right alongside the road. You know, it's a sign. It just says Naval Undersea Warfare Center, and I pulled over the road and pulled up my camera to the window, and just before I shot the picture, I heard a whole bunch of screaming and yelling. I looked at the little guard shack, and they're waving their arms and running over to me. So I put it in drive, and I just pulled across the road, and I said, you know, is there a problem? And there was a lady there screaming, you can't take pictures here. This is a, you know, secret base, and I could call the MPs and have your camera confiscated. And I said, well, you know, I didn't mean any harm. I mean, everybody looks at this sign. I'm not taking a picture of anything inside. There's nothing to take a picture of. She says, I don't care about that. You can't do this. And you turn right around. I said, well, do you think I could get a tour? And she said, no, you can't get a tour. So I drove off, but it seemed a lot of fuss. If I was running that base, I would certainly not do something like that. If somebody drove up, I'd say, hey, can I help you, sir? You know, we're not giving tours today, but maybe if you write us, we'll give you tours. But sure, take a picture, sign, whatever you want. Make it real low-key there. Don't make a big fuss about it, because if you make a fuss about it, then somebody's going to wonder, what the heck is in there anyway?
Well, yeah, it's like Area 51, you know, the fact that everybody knew that base was out there. There'd been little newspaper articles about it for a lot of years, and it didn't really start getting interesting until they started denying that the base was out there.
Right, and you'll remember that it was 18 years ago that you released the information on Bob Lazar. And, you know, when I go on the different forums, like AboveTopSecret.com, a lot of the people, you know, they don't believe the Bob Lazar story. And when I look back, I don't blame them. Because, you know, you and I lived it. We were with Bob. We knew Bob. We were in his house. We saw him leave for work. We went up and saw the flying saucers fly. You know, and it was real to us. But 18 years later, you see the story on the Internet. Hey, guy works on flying saucers for the U.S. government. They're not going to believe that.
Yeah. It's amazing how much water is under the bridge since then. We'll come back to Bob in just a second. I want to stick with the sub base for a second now. On a scale of 1 to 10, on the John Lear scale of credibility, how much do you believe, 1 being least, 10 being most?
10.
That this shaft goes 1,400 feet down into it, and people get on submarines in Hawthorne and go to the Pacific Ocean?
No doubt about it. And, you know, there's many Navy facilities around the United States. I think the United States, there's a vast undersea area. I don't know how far it goes. I suspect that there's access up in Idaho to Lake Penderay, probably Coeur d'Alene, where a lot of Navy research goes. You know, I had a friend here who was in charge of the Lake Mead Naval Air Station, or Naval Air Base here, and he told me of a secret facility in Lake Tahoe. And just today I was talking with a friend. He said, oh, yeah, that is a real secret base. And he told me the story about Jacques Cousteau, who went down in the submarine in 1975 to see what was down there. And when he came up, they said, what'd you see? And he said, the world is not ready to know what I saw. You know, and that's on record. So,
well, why keep this secret? You said that there's more than one of these kinds of facilities all around the country, like Ohio and places like that, is what you told me when we chatted. But why keep this a secret? If you can get to a submarine and get to the ocean from down there, what's the big deal?
Everything's a secret, George. Everything that the military does is a secret. You know that in the last few years I've been working on our bases on the moon. We've been on the moon since 1962. We've been on Mars since 1966. We have at least 6 space stations orbiting Earth. You know, next time you watch Discovery take off, it takes off on the 23rd. Just notice the time that it takes off from Kennedy and docks with a space station. It's usually about 72 hours. Now, it doesn't take that long to go up there and dock. And what they're doing is they're stopping at the other space stations, dropping off supplies. When they get to the ISS, usually a few days before, the Russians have sent 2 Progress rockets up there, and that cargo is put back onto the U.S. space shuttle. And then when they undock, guess how long it takes them to get back to Kennedy? 72 hours. Well, you know, the trip is only 20 minutes, so they got to be doing something else. And what they're doing is they're taking those supplies that Progress brought up and going back through the line, supplying the other space stations. You know,
isn't there
stuff like this, going on, and it's a secret. We'll never know about it. And I'll tell you one thing. I met the other day with an Air Force intelligence guy and my associate, Ron Schmidt. And we came up in my den. We talked for several days. And at the end of this time, I said, you know, fellas, on a scale of 0 to 100, 0 meaning we don't know anything, 100 being We know everything the government knows. Where do you think we are? And our general consensus was between 0.5 and 0.7. Now, since that time, I revised the scale to 0 to 1,000, being we still know only 0.5 to 0.7. We know nothing. Now, you mentioned St. Louis. You know, there's a huge underground submarine testing center there, and I think they access it, access that by going up up the Mississippi.
This stuff,
all these stories I'm telling you can be found on AboveTopSecret.com. The guy posted, you know, when I posted the original story on Hawthorne, he came on and said, you know, my dad worked on an underground facility that was a huge body of water there in St. Louis, and he worked on nuclear submarines.
You know, I don't have trouble believing the idea that we could have secret satellites up there or space stations. I mean, that's technically feasible. A lot of folks don't want to believe about UFOs or whatever. That is something we could do. What I don't understand is why there's no way to detect it. Shouldn't someone have access to that information to be able to say, aha, we see it up there?
No. Well, yeah, you can see the space stations. There's many photos of them, film that a guy took in Santa Monica. I think they call him Santa Monica John, and that's not me. And he had a telescope that would track satellites. And what he did is he followed them, and they're amazing satellites. I mean, and this stuff is on, you can, get it on YouTube or AboveTopSecret.com, but there's got to be at least 10 different film clips of these huge space stations, you know, orbiting Earth.
Let's go back to Bob Lazar for a second. Have you been in touch with Bob regarding the matter I mentioned earlier, the hassle he's been getting from the government about the sale of various kinds of chemicals and scientific equipment?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, on the web ATS, the story came up of the 115 and the experiment we did, and I was trying to tell him how we did it, and I forgot what we used in the bell jar for the gamma, alpha, and beta rays, and I emailed him, and he said it was thorium oxide, and also he emailed me that I'm not sure whether it was the same CBS production, but I saw one of them that that had a real good production on what he does and how science is falling behind, and it's really not falling behind. I mean, our secret government is so far ahead that people just wouldn't believe what we're doing now.
Well, just to bring the listeners up to date who may not know the story, Element 115 is what Bob Lazar claimed back in 1989 is the fuel used to power flying saucers that our government somehow acquired from some other race. And Lazar had said that he had a piece of it for a time period, and he even conducted some experiments that John Lear witnessed and which I have on videotape. And one of these days I got to find that tape for you, John.
Yeah, listen, all you guys, hear what George Knapp says? He has the videotape.
that might have been a mistake, huh? But have you been in touch with Bob about the legal difficulties he's undergoing with regard to what he sells on his company?
Yeah, you know, he just had the court case and finished that up, and now he's being real careful. But, you know, some of the people that post say that the stuff that he got busted for is ridiculous. Everybody uses that stuff. It's not dangerous at all.
What was the end result? Did he get punished?
Yeah, I think he got a $7,500 fine and 2 years probation.
And is he not allowed to sell that stuff anymore?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, they're clamping down on all that stuff.
Let's talk briefly about Area 52. I mentioned it in regard to the wild horses that died up there, but I'm also working on some stories about what goes on out at that place. The Tonopah Test Range, it's been a facility in place there for a long time, a sister facility to Area 51. What do you think is going on out there now?
Well, the real secret is the facility halfway between Tonopah and Groom Lake, and that's called Sandia. And Sandia was initially constructed between 1980 and 1987. It's a huge, huge underground base that's in what they call Area 19 on the Paiute Mesa. There's a couple of runways there. And there's also a couple of runways, I think, that are called Station 9 out in the flatlands there. And it's just an enormous operation, and they've done a good job keeping it secret. And one of the ways they've kept it secret is because everybody watches the special projects airplanes, you know, the red and white 737s, and, you know, it's kind of hard to shuffle a couple of thousand people into a secret base without anybody knowing it. So what they did is they built these underground high-speed trains that go from Las Vegas to Sandia, and they what they did is they have the entrances, if you can believe this, under two or three of the major hotels, and the workers, they just pull up into guest parking for the hotel, walk in, you know, some nondescript door, there'll be some, you know, elevator that only they have access to, and they go down and they get on this tram or this high-speed train that goes up to Sandia.
Got to tell you, John, I have trouble with that part of it. I have no doubt that they could have underground facilities out there, but the underground train part, I mean, for one thing, if that's true, the people of Las Vegas should really be ticked off because we could use that this train technology to solve some of our woeful traffic problems.
You know, George, since the 60s, the Navy has had a high-speed train system that goes at least nationwide and probably worldwide. And the underground tunnels that we have that people drive daily go thousands of miles. There's so much stuff going underground that nobody has a clue. And when you say you have trouble with this, remember when I brought you the Bob Lazar story, you had trouble with that. And not only that, Bob Lazar had the same problem when I initially started talking about saucers up at Area 51. He said, this is ridiculous. He said, I went to Los Alamos. I had a Q clearance. If that was true, I would have known it. And that's the exact words that Bob Lazar told me. And then, you know, 4 or 5 months later, you know, one thing led to another. He came up to my house, sat in the chair, and he said, John, he said, I saw a disc today. And I said, theirs or ours? He said, theirs. And I said, well, what are you doing here? And he said, because you've taken so much crap over this, I wanted to tell you it's true.
One more question about Tonopah, though, is what is it that they're doing out there? They've got these underground facilities, and they're secretly flying in employees. What are they working on?
You know, I don't know exactly. I think that may be where NORAD is moving. So, you know, I don't know exactly what they're doing.
You said they've got something enough to store thousands or host thousands of troops?
Yeah, they have those five circular facilities, and they were digging those when Bob was here. And they go about a mile underground, and each one can hold, I think, 25,000 combat troops and their officers, and there's five of them. And the reason we knew is one of the guys we knew drove the dump truck, and what they do is they'd set off a clean, if you can believe it, clean nuclear bomb to make the original hole. Then they'd tunnel down there, and they'd head this road on the side of this huge hole, and they take the concrete down there and start building this entire facility. And there's five of those, and that's separate from the Sandia part.
Years ago, before the world knew about the stealth fighter, you and Jim Goodall and John Andrews used to go up to Tonopah, sit around outside the fence, pull out your lawn chair, and watch for it because you know, the people of Tonopah had been seeing these things flying in the sky for a long time. They kept their mouths shut. You guys found out about it, and you saw them, didn't you?
Yeah, we went out there with our lawn chairs and Diet Pepsi, and it was usually at sunset because they didn't fly during the day. And once the security guards came up and they said, hey, you guys can't be there. And we said, sure we can. This is BLM land. And the guards would come over and say, well, now, wait a minute. We'll have to see some ID. And so we showed him our ID, and I heard him talking to his little radio phone there, and he said, it's okay. It's only Lear and Goodall.
But, I mean, it shows that secrets can and are kept.
Absolutely, positively. I mean, there are so many secrets. It's just really interesting.
I want to ask you about one other subject, if we have time to get into this. It's about torture planes. John, you flew for the CIA. You know how it works. You've read the same news accounts about torture. There's a movie that opened up this weekend called Rendition, you know, in which these private shell companies are used by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. They go and snatch people up off the suspected terrorists up off the street, take them to hidden prisons, torture them. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't doubt it at all. You know, I've been out of the business for, you know, I've been out of flying for 7 years, and I haven't done anything for the agency since 1983. But, you know, that stuff goes on.
Just the idea of America being the nation of the good guys, does it bother you? Or you think there's practical uses for that?
No, there's no practical uses. The whole war on terrorism is a scam. It never happened. Never, you know, it was all stuff that we did to ourselves. It doesn't exist. It's a perpetuation of the original report in 1960, the report from Iron Mountain, that the economy can only be sustained on a wartime basis. And so we have to create wars, and that's the only reason we did this.
Wow, that's a lot to chew on there. We'll have to have you back, and we can get into that and some more. So start digging up some more conspiracies, John. We'll have you on and again in a couple of months.
Okay, thanks, George.
All right, thank you. We'll be coming back. We'll be joined by British author Tim Good. Talk about UFOs, government secrets, conspiracies. Stick around. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM.